The reading today is taken from the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 23 to chapter 12, verse 3. It can be found on page 1212. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as if on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab, the prostitute, did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had been given a friendly welcome to the spies. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered the kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with a sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And all this, though commanded through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witness, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted.
Earlier this month, Charles Ramsey hit the news, didn't he? So he became a bit of a national hero in the States when he engaged in this daring rescue of 3 women and a girl from a house where they'd been held captive for some 10 years. So he heard this woman scream in the neighbour's house, and instead of saying, well, you know, not my problem, I'm not going to get involved, he leapt into action and he leapt into the neighbour's place and kicked down some door and he set these women free. And, you know, he's a big hero. Since then, some people have started an online campaign to raise money to reward him for his courage. And 14 restaurants have awarded him free burgers for life. What a lucky man. We love stories of courage, don't we? They're inspiring, they're uplifting. And, you know, if you stop people in the street out on, you know, West India Quay this evening and you ask them what the word courage brings to mind, I guess we'd all have our own favourite stories of courage and daring do that we would tell. But probably not many of those stories, if you stop people and ask, not many of those stories would be to do with faith. That is to say, for most people, if you played a word association game with them and you said, what springs to mind when I say the word courage? Not many people would say faith, Christian faith. The more common view is that faith is a crutch. So faith is for weak people, people who can't stand on their own 2 feet. Faith is for wimps, it's for escapists who can't cope with the harsh reality of life. Or faith is about vicarage garden parties and flower rotors and bell ringing and church fetes and so on. There's nothing remotely courageous about it. I wonder what your own view of faith is, that is to say Christian faith. So do you see it as something which requires courage Is that an obvious link in your mind? Because it's plain from our passage today, Kenny's just read, so Hebrews 11, 23, all the way to 12, 3, it's clear that courage and faith go hand in hand in the Bible. And what we have in this chapter, chapter 11, is a catalogue of Old Testament heroes of faith. And they dispel any idea that faith is just for wimps or faith is a crutch for the weak. These are courageous people. And so if you're a Christian this evening, do you consider yourself to be courageous? You need to be to live the life of faith. And these tales of courage are here to inspire us to be courageous and to keep going in the Christian race. And if you're not a Christian, I hope they'll challenge you at the very least to maybe reconsider your view of faith. Last week we looked at people like Abel and Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. The spotlight now falls on Moses. So if you look at 11:23, the passage begins, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict." Exodus 1 tells the story of how when God's people were slaves in Egypt, the Pharaoh had ordered the killing of all the Hebrew baby boys. But when Moses was born, his parents hid him. And verse 23 here tells us that it was by faith they did that. And by faith, it says, they weren't afraid of the king. So like the Hebrew midwives we read about in Exodus 1, they feared God more than they feared this ruthless dictator who had ordered this genocide. Now this courageous faith which Moses' parents had clearly rubbed off on him, had a profound influence on Moses when he grew up to be a man. And I don't know, perhaps as he grew up, maybe this story of his birth was retold around the evening fire and it inspired him. Because when he became a man, he was marked by the same sort of courageous faith that his parents had had. So if you look at verse 27, it says that by faith he left Egypt. This is now fast forward to Moses as a man. By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king. And Exodus tells this story of how Moses as a man, he courageously led the people of Israel up out of Egypt. He didn't fear Pharaoh during the plagues, during the subsequent pursuit. Now, do you see the link between 23 and 27? 23, his parents were not afraid of the king's edict. 27, Moses was not afraid of the anger of the king. Yeah, his parents and him, they weren't afraid of the king. And there's certainly a challenge in this, I think, for those of us who are parents, that our values will shape our children. You know, what values will they pick up from us? Will it be courageous faith or will it be compromise and cowardly conformity? Will it be materialism? Our actions will speak louder than our words. But there's a challenge for all of us, whether or not we're parents, and that is that faith does not fear people. Faith does not fear people. Or if it does fear them, it still acts and does what is right, in spite of the fear. Nelson Mandela said, "I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear." And at one level, you could say there can be no courage unless you are afraid, unless you are scared. So what is courage? Courage is about doing what you are afraid to do. And so someone has said this, that the one who feels no fear is a fool, but the one who lets fear rule him is a coward. Faith requires courage. The courage not to let fear of other people keep us from doing what is right. Sometimes it is the fear of other people that keeps someone from actually becoming a Christian in the first place. You know, what will others think of me? Sometimes the fear of other people keeps a Christian from doing what is right. You know, what is it that keeps us from speaking up more when we should? From standing as a Christian? From sharing the gospel with other people? From behaving differently rather than going with the crowd? Is it not this fear of other people? What they'll think, what they'll do? What is the fear of other people keeping you from doing at the moment that you know you should be doing? Faith does not fear other people, and faith stands with God's people. So verse 24 says that by faith Moses, when he was grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. You may remember the story how Pharaoh's daughter found the baby Moses in that basket in the reeds in the river. And when the child grew, he became her son. He became the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now Moses had it all. As a young man, Moses had the front door keys to the palace. He had the world at his feet. This guy had it made. Security, wealth, honor, power, inheritance. Moses would have been Egypt's most eligible bachelor. Yeah, this guy would have been all over the front cover of Hello magazine. But he gave it all up for the sake of the people of God. It says here, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. So what happened was one day he saw one of God's people being beaten by an Egyptian slave master. What would you have done in his situation? Would you have walked away? I guess it would have been fairly tempting to rationalize and to say, well, you know, long term, I guess I could have more influence if I just keep my head down and live in the palace. Could have a lot more influence that way long term. Now he stepped in, he rescued this fellow believer. And in that one act, he lost everything. He became a fugitive, he was on the run, he was hunted down with the people of God. He had to flee for his life. He spent the next 40 years of his life living in exile in the wilderness, working as a shepherd. It was a costly decision. But that is what faith does. Faith stands with the people of God, whatever the cost. What will it cost you and me to identify with God's people? To be known as a Christian? To make a stand? To share the gospel? To live differently? What will it cost you? What will it cost you at work? What will it cost you at home? What will it cost you at church? You know, committing to a church family is part of standing with the people of God. Committed to serving them takes time, takes energy, takes money. And for some people, serving God's people involves giving up quite a lot to go abroad. John Pollock is a great Christian biographer. One of his books, which is on the table over there, you can have a look at it afterwards and buy it even. One of his books is called The Cambridge Seven. And it tells this wonderful story of seven leading young men of the late 19th century. They were all Cambridge grads and they gave up everything to go and serve God in China. One of them was a guy called C.T. Studd. He was born and bred in luxury. He had it all. He was a bit of a Moses figure in that respect. He was the finest cricketer of his day. He was captain of the England cricket team. And he gave it all up to go to China to tell people the gospel. Well, we can think a bit closer to home of our own James and Caroline Steer, who we had our Skype link with our last prayer supper in Thailand, this remote part of Thailand, you know, in a church of about 15 adults, and they're surrounded by Buddhists, and, you know, there James is with his PhD in chemistry and slogging away trying to learn the Thai language. You know, what motivates people to make those sort of courageous choices? Well, verse 26 here says that in Moses' case, he was looking to the reward. And verse 27 says that he was seeing as seeing him who is invisible. So Moses gave it all up because he was looking to the eternal reward. In fact, verse 26 said that he considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. We'll only make these sort of courageous choices if we are looking to the eternal reward, if we're looking to the invisible God. But that is what faith does. So as we heard last week, that faith sees the unseen. Faith sets its heart and its mind on things above. And if we just focus on the here and now, if we just focus on what will guarantee us material comfort and an easy life, we will not live the life of faith. A few weeks ago, I was at a preaching conference and there were about, I guess, 30 of us young guys, flatter myself, about 30 of us anyway, and the speaker from Australia said, imagine, he said, that right now armed gunmen, armed men, burst into the room, and they're from some fundamentalist group, and they round us all up and they say this: you have a choice. Those who renounce Christ now can walk out through that door and go home. You can go back to your wives and your families. But if you don't renounce, your faith will shoot you. It happens in countries today. What would you do? Would you think, well, you know, if actually I'd probably be much better used to the Lord if I did just walk through that door, be much more used to my family, more useful to the gospel long term. If I just say I renounce Christ, I don't have to mean it, I'll just say it, and so keep my fingers crossed behind my back or something. And what would you do? Or would you stay? You would only stay if you had a clear view of eternity. Now, the choice doesn't have to be quite so dramatic. Just to bring it down a few levels, just think of, to pick one area of our lives, the area of a relationship. The single person facing the temptation of going out, the single Christian person facing the temptation of going out with and marrying someone who's not a Christian. Or the person who is going out and is facing the temptation of being sexually immoral. Or the person who experiences same-sex attraction and faces the temptation of a relationship. Or the married person facing the temptation of an affair. What you choose will depend on what you see. So are you looking to your eternal reward? Are you seeing him who is invisible? Or are you just looking at this life and short-term gain? Faith acts with courage and stands with the people of God. And secondly, faith understands with clarity. What does faith understand? Well, it understands that the stakes are high. That salvation and judgment is what is at stake. And that, I think, is the common denominator in the next few events. So verse 28 says, by faith Moses kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. So you remember that in faith Moses, he obeyed God's instructions to sprinkle the blood around the door frames. And so God's people were saved from judgment. You know, Moses believed in salvation and judgment. He knew that was what was at stake. Or verse 29 says, by faith the people crossed the Red Sea as if on dry land. But the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. So again, God's people obeyed God because they knew it was a question of salvation or destruction. They were saved, the Egyptian army was drowned. Well, look at the next example, verse 30. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. How ridiculous it must have seemed to walk around that city 7 times blowing trumpets. But they obeyed because they believed salvation and judgment was at stake. And sure enough, Jericho was destroyed. Or the last example there, verse 31, says, by faith, Rahab the prostitute didn't perish with those who were disobedient because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. So there was a Gentile prostitute who threw in a lot with God's people. Why? Well, because she knew the disobedient were going to perish. So in each of those episodes, you've got this same theme of salvation and judgment. And faith understands that that is what is at stake. And so faith goes God's way. If we are to be people of faith, if we are to keep going as people of faith, we need to understand clearly what is at stake. From beginning to end, the Bible is a story of salvation and judgment. God's people will be saved eternally, and God's enemies will be overthrown and destroyed. And that is the framework in which we operate as God's people. That is what is at stake. And faith understands that, and faith acts upon it. Now, these Old Testament people clearly understood this. And how much more clearly should we, given what we now know, having a complete Bible? Eternity lies before us, and it's either an eternity of eternal life or of condemnation. Jesus talked very plainly about this, didn't he? Matthew 25, 46, for example, Jesus said, these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Now we need to put our daily decisions, our daily choices within that eternal perspective, within that framework. That is why we need to keep going in faith. That is why we need to act courageously. That is why we need to stand with God's people. That is the perspective of faith. There's a verse in Malachi 3:18 where the Lord says this: "Then once more you shall see the distinction between the righteous and the wicked, between one who serves God and one who does not serve him." Now then, in the age to come, that sort of distinction will be crystal clear. But in the present, in this life, it may not often seem as if going the way of the world is, which option is better? Should I go God's way? Should I go the world's way? Which is better? It doesn't always seem obvious if you just look at the here and now. In fact, Jeremiah laments this. He said in Jeremiah 12:1, "Why does the way of the wicked prosper?" Well, maybe you think that when you look around. You think, well, people who don't follow God, they seem to have a pretty good life, seem to get away with it. You know, why should I go God's way? Perhaps you're facing some decision at the moment, and you've got a very clear choice between going God's way or going your own way, going the world's way. And you're sort of right up close to this choice, and it's sort of very much in your face. As you weigh up what you're going to do, just pull back for a moment and put that choice within the perspective of eternity, eternal salvation, eternal judgment. Where will you be in a million years' time? And how will that choice look like looking back from the vantage point of a million years hence? We need this eternal perspective. And we need it because in the life of faith, sometimes going God's way, sometimes it does mean things work out better now in this life, but sometimes they don't. But faith, well, faith reckons with God's providence. And that's the theme of the next bit as we turn to our third point. So faith reckons with God's providence. In verses 32 to 35, we've got a catalogue of what we could call triumphant heroes. Verse 32 says, "And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah," those are four judges, "of David," that is the king, "and Samuel, a prophet judge, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms." So just think of the military victories of David. "Enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions." Who was that? Daniel. "Quenched the power of the fire." Who was that? What? Huh? Okay, well, I was thinking of Daniel's three friends. Maybe Elijah as well. "Escaped the edge of the sword." That could be David fleeing from Saul. "Would made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection." Does that ring any Old Testament bells? Yep, good. Elijah and the widow, and Elisha had an example as well. You know, they've got this triumphant collection, these triumphant heroes. But in the history of faith, for every story of military victory or miraculous deliverance from danger and death, there is a contrasting story of defeat and suffering and people not being delivered. So do you see how things go on? And you've got this contrast actually in verse 35. The verse 35 begins, "Women receive back their dead by resurrection." So there you've got miraculous deliverance from death. But, it goes on, "some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise to a better life." So no deliverance for them. And it goes on, "others suffered mocking and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with a sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth." That's a really, really stark contrast, isn't it, between those two sections. The triumphant heroes, the suffering heroes. And I think it's summed up, if you look at the contrast between verse 34 and 37, it epitomizes it. So 34 says, "some people of faith escaped the edge of the sword." Verse 37 says, "other people of faith were killed with the sword." Now this is such an important lesson, because the lesson is, that faith does not always mean deliverance. Faith does not always mean deliverance. Faith does not mean necessarily that things will work out and things will come good. The experience of the people of faith will vary hugely in this life. So you may have one Christian who is miraculously healed from cancer, and you may have another Christian who dies from cancer. One Christian may lose their job in a wave of cuts. Another Christian may survive and get promoted. One Christian meets a wonderful person and gets married, and another Christian who wants to get married doesn't meet the right person and remains single. One Christian couple have 10 kids, and another Christian couple can't have any. And there's no difference at all between them when it comes to faith. They both believe, and they both have the same strength of faith. Faith does not mean that all your hopes and dreams always come true and our prayers are always answered as we want. Faith recognizes and reckons with God's providence. And by providence, what we mean is this, that God is in control and God is working out his purposes, but there is a mystery about that and we just need to trust him. Now, sometimes people teach that faith does mean that everything will work out. If only you have enough faith, then you will be healed. Or then you will get that job. Or then you'll meet the right person. And then the relationship will work out. And that is unbiblical. And it is also cruel. Because what happens to that person's faith when they don't get healed? Or when the relationship doesn't work out? Well, one of two things happens. Either they despair that their faith wasn't strong enough, and so it's my fault, I didn't have strong enough faith. Or they conclude that it's God's problem, that God let them down, and it's his fault. Sometimes faith means you experience miraculous deliverance and provision, and sometimes faith means being enabled to keep going when there is no deliverance. It means enduring when there is no healing and when you're facing death. A friend in New Zealand sent me this past week, part of an email from a woman in his congregation. He describes her as a wonderful, lovely, beautifully thoughtful 50-year-old lady who has got 8 kids from ages 11 and upwards. And she's dying of cancer. She's got a few weeks or possibly months to live. Woman of radiant faith who's about to leave behind her 8 children. Faith reckons with God's providence. And faith ultimately has the perspective of verses 39 to 40. If you look at that, verse 39 says, all these, so the triumphant heroes, the suffering heroes, all these, though commended through their faith, they didn't receive what was promised. Since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. That was true of both the triumphant heroes and the suffering heroes, that none of them ultimately received what was promised in this life. They were heading for the heavenly country, the better country, the heavenly city. If you want a can of Coke, you put your coin in the vending machine and out pops your can of Coke at the bottom. But faith is not this coin that we put into God's vending machine and out pops our best life now. You know, the dream life that we ordered. God's promises are ultimately of a better country and a heavenly city in the age to come. And faith looks to that. And faith accepts that in the life of faith now, our prayers for deliverance are not always going to be answered as we want. Faith reckons with God's providence. And it runs with endurance towards the goal. And that's our final point. That's the picture in the first few verses of chapter 12. So chapter 12 verse 1 says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. The Christian life is not a jacuzzi, it's not a bubble bath, it is a race. And it's not a 100-meter sprint, it is a marathon. It is a long-distance race which requires endurance. It says, let us run with endurance. What is endurance if you had to define it? Well, basically, endurance is stamina to keep going in spite of difficulty. In spite of difficulty, and that is what we need as Christians. So faith is certainly not for wimps. And if we're going to run with endurance, we need to do what verse 1 says. So verse 1 says, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. Some of you here, I guess, have done marathons, maybe. If you're running a marathon, imagine lining up at the start wearing an overcoat, wellies and a rucksack. I mean, some people do it for charity, but you wouldn't do it if it's a serious race. You wouldn't do that in the Olympics. In a serious race, the athletes are wearing as little as possible. Embarrassingly so. These sort of skimpy little shorts and singlets that they wear, and they've got these lightweight running shoes, and they get rid of anything that is going to slow them down, including any excess body weight. Long-distance runners, they're lean and mean, aren't they? There's not an ounce of fat on these people. The Christian race is not a fun run. It's not for charity. It's not sort of pantomime horse territory. It is a matter of life and death. And the prize is much bigger than this piece of metal on the end of a coloured ribbon. The stakes are eternal. And so the writer says we need to get rid of anything and everything which is slowing us down in the Christian race. We need to lay aside every weight or sin. Well, how's the running going at the moment? Are you flying or are you flagging? What is slowing you down? A bad habit, a wrong relationship, an unresolved issue, a particular sin. Sometimes we can actually physically feel it, can't we? That physically we feel that something is weighing us down and making us drag our feet in the Christian race. Why not resolve, even right now this evening, to lay aside whatever it is today so you can get back up to speed in the Christian race? Why not resolve right now that you will stop that bad habit? You'll repent of that sin. You'll have that conversation you need to have, whatever it is. I don't know, maybe you can remember times past when you were sort of flying around the course. But maybe now it feels like you're wearing some 30-kilo rucksack. Lay it aside and pick up the pace. And to motivate us, the writer here tells us to look at the faces in the crowd. Verse 1 says, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us do these things. Imagine being in the Olympic Stadium with 80,000 people in these tiered seats watching you. You're there on the track, or you're running a marathon and you've got the streets lined with all these spectators. That is the picture here. But the crowd of spectators for us are the people of chapter 11. So these Old Testament heroes of the faith, they're described here as a cloud of witnesses. And cloud just means a great crowd, a great throng of witnesses. But the point of the crowd is not so much that they are looking at us, but the point is that we are looking at them and being inspired by them. It's not so much that the crowd are looking at us, it's that we are looking at them and inspired by them. So if you're an athlete, if you've got a cheering crowd, it makes a big difference to you, doesn't it? It lifts your game. And of course, that's one reason why the host country always tend to do well in the Olympics, because it's home crowd. Or it's why it's easier for football teams to win home matches than away matches. The crowd lifts you. And so these men and women of faith we've been reading about are there to inspire us. And as we run around the track, the idea is that we're to see the individuals in the crowd and we're to think of their stories and we're to be inspired by them. Often at sporting events, you'll have heroes from the past who are in the crowd watching. And I guess it must really lift you if you're, playing a match of football and suddenly you pick out in the crowd the face of Bobby Charlton. It's going to inspire you, lift your game. Or you're playing tennis and there's Becker, there's McEnroe on the front row. Or you're running and then there's Sebastian Coe watching. It lifts you. And so as we run the Christian race, the idea is that we are to look to these former athletes and be inspired. And as we look in the crowd, we say, oh, there's Abraham, there's Moses, there's Rahab, Gideon, Samson. And let's face it, the race of faith was certainly no easier for these guys. In fact, in many cases, it was much harder than anything that we face. But they kept going And the point is, we should be inspired by them. In that crowd are all the runners from down the ages who finished the race and kept the faith. So yes, those in the Bible, but also those who have lived since the Bible was written. And that is a very good reason for reading church history. You start to put a face to other figures in the crowd. And their stories then inspire you. So I've got a book at home called 12 Reformation Heroes. People like Wycliffe, Huss, Luther, Tyndale, Knox. The dust jacket says, a tale of courage, gripping all who admire the courageous. And on it goes. And the history of God's people is full of these sort of empowering examples of people who have proved that the grace of God is sufficient to enable us to endure to the end and to be saved. Now, if we're ignorant of all this history, we're missing out on a fantastic resource and a source of strength in the race. But the ultimate past runner to be inspired by is sitting in the royal box, and that is Jesus himself, the greatest runner of all time. So if you look at verse 2, it says that we are to be those who are looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. The Christian race for Jesus involves suffering that we will never experience anything like in our own lives. Such hostility from sinners, it says, and the cross, the pain, the shame of that. But he endured. And his endurance is mentioned twice, verse 2, verse 3. Now, at one level, of course, Jesus' suffering is unique, it's unrepeatable. But at another level, Jesus is a model for us and an inspiration, and we need to look to him and we need to be inspired by him to keep going. John Piper has got a series of three books on figures from church history. And one book is called The Roots of Endurance, and it's on the table over there if you want to buy it. It's about Simeon and Newton and Wilberforce. And in the final pages he says this: Jesus Christ is the deepest root of endurance. Seeing and savoring him is the source of strength that keeps us striving against sin and Satan and sickness and sabotage. Jesus, the ultimate example. How did Jesus keep going? Did you spot it in verse 2? It says, for the joy set before him. What keeps any runner going in a race? Isn't it the joy of finishing, the prospect of winning, the thought of the prize? So you endure in a running race not because the race is such fun, but because of the goal. And this is saying it is the same in the Christian race. That what kept Jesus going was looking to the future. The joy of being back with the Father, the joy of sitting at the Father's right hand, the joy of eternity with his saved people, that is where his focus was. And it is the same for us. That we will keep going by looking to the joy set before us in eternity. That is what will stop us from growing weary and faint-hearted and giving up. But that also means that if we lose sight of the future of that goal, we are going to really struggle to keep going in the Christian race. Are you weary in the race at the moment? Look at the great cloud of witnesses. So these men and women of faith in the Bible, in church history, and in different situations today. And so we need to get to know the Old Testament if we're going to be inspired by these guys. We need to read church history. And in fact, I put on the table on the right-hand side there, I put a selection of books from the bookstall about figures from church history. Why not buy one and read? We need to get to know about Christians in other situations today who are suffering a lot more than we do. So if you don't get the Open Doors or the Barnabas Fund prayer diaries, why not sign up for those and get them and be inspired? These people are inspirational. And what they have had to endure can put our own trials and circumstances in perspective. But above all, look to Jesus and consider him.